Welcome to episode 3447. The fan has hit the shit. That's today's episode. Is there any real reason to flip it around? Nah, just sounds cool. That's the only reason why. And we live in a world where I think that all of the talk of, you know, when the shit hits the fan is, you know, we're going to do this and that. We're missing it, bro. We're missing it, sister, right? Like, We had that happen a long time ago, and it's a continuous thing where everybody's getting dusted with it and doesn't realize it, and they're still waiting for it to happen. We talked about that recently in an episode. We are out of the gate about 5 minutes early today. I expect this to be a huge turnout for the live stream, because no matter how much I preach solutions, what people seem to really want to hear about is all the problems. So we are going to dig into some of the problems today. Our lead story is going to be a interview by Tucker Carlson, and not the one with Putin, though we're going to talk about that too. Now, this is an interview he did a few weeks ago. I think it was right before he went to Russia, and it was with an insider from the pharmaceutical industry. Now, what I think many people didn't realize in that interview is he'd interviewed that man before. Yes, that man worked heavily with Big Pharma, but he also worked heavily with Big Food, and he was on more of the lobbying side and kind of the private lobbying side. People don't realize that's a thing. That's where you go out and you get groups, like the NAACP, to come out and say something like, if you say anything negative about people drinking soda being unhealthy, then that's racist. And they just pay these organizations to do this. Well, he did that interview. That was about 2 years ago, I think, maybe a year and a half. He was just back on again. He was talking about the pharmaceutical industry directly and specifically about Ozempic. But I'm going to tell you that it's much deeper than that. So there's four things. There's like 40 things in that video that if you watch the whole thing, your brain should want to come out of your eyes. But there's four things that I picked out to cover with you today that every American should just be completely outraged by. But most aren't, because if you're eating this crap, you're all lulled into like compliance. How about the fact that pharma does exactly what I said? And I must have gotten, I bet, 50 emails. Jack, it's what you've been saying the whole time. Pharma spends about 50% of all spend on television ads. 50%. Half of all advertising revenue for pharma. Not to get you to buy dope. No, to control the media. How about 10% of all food stamps? You know what they cover? Soda. 10% of EBT covers the purchase of sugar water. We're going to talk about this in depth today. How about this? The plan for any obese teen? Now, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, is to put them on Ozempic for life. You have a 15-year-old who's fat and put him on Ozempic for the rest of his life, however long it may be, at $1,200 a month, about $20,000 a year in expense. Don't worry, I'm sure the cost will come down with economy of scale when we get into trillion-dollar territory, because that's the forecast for revenue, and it's all in the United States because nobody around the world is doing what we're doing with this drug because they're not as stupid as we are. If your blood's not boiling yet, how about this statement? Nothing is more profitable to the drug companies than a chronically sick child. Someone you can put on a drug at that age and keep them on it for 70 years if they stay alive that long. That is how the number crunching is being done. We're going to stick with Tucker, though, on the Putin interview. I'm going to go very short on the Putin interview because it was very long in of itself. But I'm going to tell you why the Putin interview probably won't wake up as many people as it should, and how sad that is, and why that is. And it has to do with like the first 30 minutes of the thing being like an encyclopedia of knowledge spewing from Putin of how did we get here, starting from the foundation of Russia in the 7th century, 800 AD timeline, up till now. And why that doesn't work with people in America, and how sad that is, and why it should, and why it won't. We're also going to, you know, I think a lot of people think that I am some sort of fan of Putin or something. I'm not. But I want to point out, just for those special children that don't understand, that you can say, hey, there's a valid opinion on this side of the argument. That doesn't mean you're all in for that person. Putin lied. He lied in that argument. I'm going to actually tell you something I heard Dennis Prager say on the radio while I was going to pick up my grandkids that he said was a lie from Putin that I don't think was a lie. But I'm going to tell you a flat-out lie. And it was a lie of, for some unknown reason. We don't know why this happened. I'll tell you why it happened. It's a bit, and I would have left it out too probably if I were him, but I wouldn't have lied about it. I would just left it out. Because it's a big part of why we have a problem today with places like Ukraine and Russia. Anyway, a new report says 2/3 of all Canadians and Americans are in unaffordable housing. I'll explain what that means and what that means as far as danger to our economic system and our way of life. The president of the United States is now considered so mentally inept that he can't be prosecuted. Even the right-wing media is undercovering the implications of this. I mean, we all knew it. But once it's in print by an official government agency, isn't it time that we all go, wait a minute, what does this mean? What does this mean? Should this be? But also, what does it mean? What does it mean? What do you think it means? I'd love to hear. What do you think that means in the live chat while I keep telling you what we're going to talk about today? The Biden administration and Biden himself, Mr. Brandon, came out and basically they've been blaming the supermarket industry for inflation. I'm going to tell you something I said in a video that I did 7 years ago that is still the case that shows how stupid this argument is. And it has nothing to do with direct inflation, monetary policy, anything. It just has to do with like business practices and principles. Okay. And then why is the U.S. considered a low corruption country? Do you know that we're considered one of the least corrupt countries in the world? Why? I'd love to hear that too. And if you're going to answer any of these things I'm prompting you for in the live chat, mention what you're answering. So if you want to answer that one, why is the U.S. considered a low corruption country? Put low corruption and then why you think it's the case. And I'll tell you why I think it's the case when we get to it. And then this is just a side note. This isn't really the world going completely crazy. This is just something I wanted to get in today because I wanted to talk about it. Backwoods Engineer on Twitter posted a video of this lady kissing the hell out of, not a transgender or whatever, a lynx, a Siberian lynx. And I won't play the video because it's all in Russian and or some language that I don't speak. And it won't really help anybody. It's not a thing. But I will bring up a still of it. But he said, why are women more likely to do this stupidity than men? Now, ironically, in the video, there's a guy, too, and he's just as dumb. We'll talk about how dangerous a lynx is. But Backwoods Engineer had a point. Women are much more likely to be afraid of things over there, but much more likely to be like, but it won't happen to me here. Why? And men do the same thing, just in a different way. We're going to talk about that because I think it's important to understand why people do dumb things. And because at some point you might be going like, wait a minute, self, is this stupid? You might recognize it in yourself and then, you know, obey one of my laws of life. Don't do stupid places and stupid with stupid people. Don't do stupid things in stupid places with stupid people. That's a good way to stay alive, by the way. Then we're going to talk about real quick toward the end. I want to give you some solutions. I want to trick you and make you hear some. You show up for the fire and the brimstone, but I'm going to give you the fire extinguisher. We're going to start out with what James Howard Kunstler, well-known author, writes a lot of apocalyptic future-looking fiction, calls too much magic. James was actually on this show, back 8 years or so, and we're going to talk about what too much magic is, but what the real solution is. It's not magic at all. It's nature. And we're going to end with how all solutions are about creating abundance. And we're going to end with a positive note on how we achieve that. But we're going to look to an industry that's a very dirty industry, a filthy industry, to understand how many of the things that we think are scarce in the world today are not. So that's what we have on docket today. That's a hell of an agenda. So let's get into it. Let's start off, though. Let's pay some bills and take care of our sponsor. Sponsor today, number one today, is KnifeKits.com. KnifeKits.com today is the oldest continuous sponsor that we've had. KnifeKits.com came on board when I first started being willing to take money from sponsors in 2009. They are still a sponsor. They have never even hinted at not being a sponsor. They pay their bills on time all of the time. And that's a long time in the world of podcasting, 2009 to 2024, if you want to do the math and figure that out. It's almost 15 years now. In fact, I think their 15-year anniversary will be in March or April of this year. That is forever in a day in the world of podcasting. So you know they support us. Support them back. They have all the cool stuff you need to learn how to make knives, whether you're a master bladesmith or just getting started. They also have stuff like to make leather sheaths, kydex holsters, all kinds of cool stuff. Check them out today. And they also do a discount for MSB members. So if you're a member, and you should be, when you go to order from Knife Kits or any of our sponsors, check, because most of them do have a discount for you, along with like a bunch of other companies. How about Start9 Sovereign Computing with their embassy servers? Guys, I'm telling you, you can change your digital footprint and future with Start9. I know it sounds complicated. I won't be able to do it all. Hey, look into what you can do with it. You can do things like run end-to-end encrypted messaging for yourself, your family, your community. I'm talking military-grade shit that nobody can break. In fact, they'd have to find it before they could break it, and they can only find it if you let them in. I'm talking about being able to access everything that you want to access, your personal files, from anywhere in the world over encrypted Tor connections. I'm talking about, like, this stuff sounds like Jason Bourne level shit. It's not, and it doesn't require anywhere near that level of sophistication. Can you install apps on your phone and use them? If you answered yes to that, you can use a Start9 Embassy server, so check them out today and take back your tech from the big technology firms. All right, so let's start digging into this. I want to start off with this video. And I have to say, it's been a long time since something came out and I got as many, hey, Jack, listen to this. You've been saying this forever responses. It was at least 50. It might be more. They start to blur together when you get the same email from different people over and over again. But we have a pharmaceutical insider that Tucker Carlson brought back on his show specifically to talk about Ozempic. Now, before I show you some of the things that are said in this video, and I'm going to show you, and if you're on the audio, you'll be able to hear the audio of it as I play it for the live stream audience and the post-production video audience as well. You just won't see it. But this, you know, again, this dude's been on before, and they're coming on here to talk about Ozempic. I cannot remember the name of the miniseries, but there is a miniseries that is on Netflix. And it is about what Purdue Pharma did with OxyContin. And if you have not seen that, you should watch it. And the reason I think many people that are like all into this type of stuff haven't is because, well, that's yesterday. That happened. It's done. It was dealt with. It's over. It's not. I mean, there's still plenty of Oxy being prescribed, even though Purdue Pharma got peeled back to almost nothing. But the bigger thing is, what do I always teach you? What is the number one thing that I try to teach out of all the things that I try to teach when it comes to how to think, not what to think? Remember, that's not my – no, the networks, the government, the scientific authority bodies, which should not be authority over anything, et cetera, all of those people tell you what to think. I talk about how to think. How to think lets you decide what to think. And when it comes to how to think, the number one thing you need in this world today is pattern recognition. Once you know a pattern, then when the pattern repeats, you're like, there's the pattern. Doesn't matter that it's in a different place. Well, the pattern in pharmaceutical is the same everywhere. You go through hell to get something approved, and then once you do, you have a free-for-all with it. You can pretty much do anything you want to incentivize doctors to prescribe your drug. And when you're going through hell to get approval, if you just buy off a few key bureaucrats by saying, you know, the thing is that once this new drug's approved, we're going to need somebody that understands the inside baseball enough to help steer it. And the best person for it would be somebody that was part of the process from the very beginning that's already worked inside the FDA or what have you. And we're going to have this opening, and it's going to pay really a lot better than any bureaucratic position. I mean, would you like to make more money than Fauci was making when he retired, plus have all these other fringe benefits? And how about a couple speaker fees? I'm not saying that they'll definitely be there, but that's how you get this done. And then once you get it done, The gloves come off. You send the pretty girls out to all the doctor's offices to flirt with them and touch their arm and talk to them and leave little stuffed animals behind and shit. And next thing you know, you do that with some of the organizations like the American Diabetes Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, et cetera. And all of a sudden you get all the endorsements and everybody's saying what you want. Then you go out to non-governmental organizations like the NAACP and you say, hey, if we give you a bunch of money, will you tell people Ozempic's good? And they do it. And we say, well, if we give you some more money, when somebody criticizes it, will you say it's racist? And they're like, sure. This is the pattern, and it's over and over and over and over and over again. But let's look at some things that you're not supposed to know, that the TV doesn't want to tell you, that somebody that's worked inside the space is going to tell you. So I want to pull up first right now this gentleman here. I don't remember his name. It doesn't really matter. And the first segment that I'm going to play for you, and hopefully I'll get them in the right order so I don't screw nothing up, is going to be about how why the pharmaceutical companies spend so much money on advertising. If you've listened to me before, there'll be nothing new here, but it might be good to hear it from another source.
This is why the stocks are going up, right? So the battle here, and this is my point to Elon and a lot of people, I want you to understand the battle is what are we going to do societally about the metabolic health crisis?
And what should we do? Like, you're in charge. I know you said you're a libertarian, but let's just imagine you were a fascist and you could do whatever you wanted. What would you do?
It's not what I think the president can do numerous things tomorrow that will dramatically. I think one of the biggest lies we're being told is this can't be turned around quickly. We did not have a metabolic health crisis a generation ago, and we can turn this down very quick. I don't think the American people are mass suicidal, frankly, which is what we're acting. We have an addiction crisis. I can give you a couple right now. The president tomorrow can tell the FDA that the U.S. can no longer be the only country in the world that allows pharma ads on TV news, which isn't to influence the consumers. It's to influence the news. Pharma buys off the news, and the FDA can issue an order tomorrow saying that that's no longer the case, that we can't have pharma spending on TV news. That is an executive decision. It can be issued tomorrow, and it would totally undercut the ability of the pharmaceutical industry to control our information. Food stamps, the ag bill.
So you think that pharma, I'm sorry,
yeah,
you're throwing so
yeah.
For my aging pizza addled yeah. brain, it's hard to keep up. But you're saying that pharma buys TV spots not to convince people to ask for specific drugs from their physicians, but to subvert the news business?
This is an open secret working for pharma.
Well, I'd never even thought of that.
This is an open secret. The kind of silly ads you see between the news breaks. The points of that is not, it's marginally to impact the customer, but the pharma's already got that. They've already bought off the doctors. They're good on that. No, this is an open secret. The news ad spending from pharma is a public relation lobbying tactic, essentially, to buy off the news. The news is a reference. They're not investigating pharma.
I've noticed.
The news has become basically a referee that you were a terrible anti-science Luddite for asking why, you know, the shots that we require our kids to get that fundamentally by their own advertising change the immune system of that child for life, why it's gone from 20 to 70. To even ask that question, the news referees that and calls you anti-science when the two largest vaccine makers in the country are literally criminal enterprises, GlaxoSmithKline and Merck. In the past 5 years has settled two of the largest criminal penalties in American corporate history.
All right. So again, if you've been listening to me for any length of time, you're like, okay, Jack says that all the time. I do think it's important though, to hear it from, you know, industry insiders that actually say, yes, this is really happening. I think it makes it more real for people. But it amazes me. Now, I don't know if Tucker really doesn't pay enough attention to what's going on in his own space to have noticed this. I don't know if he was doing a little bit of acting, but how you can be this close to this and not understand that showing a fat woman dancing, talking about how she's in better shape because she takes a pill, and then you give a notification of like 800 things that'll kill you from that pill, and then she's dancing around like she's on Broadway with a jingle mixed with something from the 70s or the 80s remixed into something stupid, or some lady's dancing through a field of poppies talking about how wonderful it is to have this drug while she has metastatic stage 4 breast cancer, and you think that is actually to get somebody to go tell their doctor to give them a drug. I don't know what the hell you're smoking if you believe that. I can't imagine. I never thought of it before. Are you playing the fool, Tucker? I don't know. But, I mean, it's the only answer that I came up with when these commercials started about 20 years ago. And they really ramped up about 15, and then they went kind of parabolic about 10 years ago. And from the very first one I saw, I'm like, wait a minute. Why are we taking, like, an old Bachman Turner Overdrive song, turning it into bubblegum happy music, and having fat people tell you how great it is to have diabetes and take this pill? And that was the only answer I had. They're buying influence. And as the ad spend went up, it became incredibly self-evident. So if you think for 1 minute the reason that they put all these ads on all and you look where they spend the most money. Now, the pharmaceutical companies are smart and they know to spread their money out. And there's only so much ad space to buy from Fox News and CNN and MSNBC, et cetera. So they focus on that. And then, like, their second tier is, like, all the daytime television shows, especially the ones with doctors on them. You know, whether they're real doctors or phony, it doesn't matter. That they like that. Any place where they talk about health, they advertise the shit out of that. Because you wouldn't want those daytime talk people, like, actually telling the non-working, sitting at home on their ass people, hey, you know what? This stuff's all bad for you. So you cover that. And then you spread the rest of it out everywhere. But the majority of it is spent on the news or on local stations during the news. Why? Because if I'm paying half your bills and I cut you off, you're going to die. You're going to financially starve to death. Most organizations, especially if you're not part of the government where you just take more money, cannot survive 50% loss of revenue. I do really well and I divide up my revenue streams pretty hard. I don't know that I would be able to make it if I lost half my revenue in a year. I really don't. I really don't. So that's why they do it. Now, how about the next one? Where do you see the next one? This should also enrage you. And I think this is the sad thing. I bet you 70 to 80% of the people in the United States, if you made them listen to what I'm about to play for you, wouldn't actually see it as a problem. I'm hoping a significant number more of you see it as a problem here in my audience. Since you understand the damage that sugar does to our systems. But listen to this.
Decisions, right? The USDA, which is completely corrupt, the guidelines that set nutrition standards, 95% of the guideline committees paid for by food companies, they say that a two-year-old, that 10% of their diet could be added sugar. We have more money from agriculture subsidies in America today go to cigarettes, go to tobacco than vegetables. 90% of subsidies go to highly processed food. We've propped this industry up. Food stamps, right, which 15% of Americans depend on for nutrition, 10% of all food stamps funding goes to soda. We're the only country in the world that allows that. So we have
to soda
goes to soda. So the
U.S. government pays people to drink soda.
The U.S. government direct from the federal treasury, more than $10 billion per year go from the federal treasury to soda companies through the food stamp program. The number one item purchased with food stamps in America is addictive diabetes water. We prop that up with food stamps. As we talked about last time, I actually used to work and consult with Coke, and we paid the NAACP and other groups to say it was racist to take that away. We totally rigged the debate. So through a corrupt system, we actually subsidize soda. We do 10 of these things, right? We do 10 easily identifiable things that are causing us, frankly, to be poisoned. And instead of talking about the root cause, we're saying that a weekly injection that you have to take for your entire life that costs $20,000 per patient when 80% of American adults are overweight or obese. We're saying that is the answer for obesity.
Okay. You get that. There's a lot to unpack in that short amount that I played for you, but a part of it isn't even why I played it. 80% of Americans today as adults are obese or overweight, and I'm pretty sure in the next segment or the one after it, you'll hear the other statistic. This should really freak you out. 50% of teens are overweight or obese. One in two. Now, I've talked about this before, But I don't know about you guys, but you guys that are in my age bracket, you know, if you're 10 years younger, 10 years older, you know, so you're anywhere between like 40 and 60, you'll probably have a similar experience. When I was in high school, middle school age, there was like a fat kid in the school, or if like at a high school where you had a bigger school, maybe there was like four or five, like a handful of fat kids, and they would be like, you know, it'd be like one in ninth grade and one or two in 10th grade and one or two in a junior and one or two that are seniors. And I bet you some of you, when I say the fat kid from school, if you're as old as me and your brain's not gone yet and you can still remember, can name the fat kid. You can name the fat kid in your school. I can. Jason Kochick. Jason Kochick was the fat kid in my school. Really obese guy. Nice guy. He was a friend, but he was the fat kid. And if you said to anybody that went to school with me, you know, that was either a junior when I was a senior, or maybe was a senior when I was a junior, that spanned those 3 years, who was the fat kid at Pottsville High School? Jason Kochick. Okay. Now, if you said the fat kid, I don't know, maybe there's a kid in some schools that's like the fattest kid and so fat that would go. Most people would be like, which one? Okay, I'm not picking on the kids at all here, guys. We didn't have a bunch of fat kids because of what we ate, and the kids today are eating the food that we're giving them as parents and adults and as a society. They are not fat because they eat more. They're fat because of what they're eating. Now, the other part. To say that a person who is so financially out of sorts that we need to provide them with money specifically to buy food, understanding this is not a welfare check. This is a welfare benefit that is specifically for food, and saying, yeah, it's fine if you buy Coke or Pepsi or Dr. Pepper or Sprite or Mountain Dew or Mellow Yellow or whatever it is with the money that we're giving you that we stole from other people so that you can eat. You're talking about the most empty nutrition that people consume, probably the primary cause of diabetes in the country. I would say that it's probably not the primary. It's got to be in the top three, because if you look at the total volume of calories that people ingest drinking this shit, and then you look at the absolute void in nutrition that it provides, and then you look at what kind of sugar is this? Is this pure cane sugar from, you know, the Caribbean islands boiled down from sugar cane? Oh, no. This is toxic gick that is extracted and then highly processed into high fructose corn syrup from corn that's genetically modified and sprayed with, you know, glyphosate and other toxic chemicals. And we give people money to buy food for their kids and then say it's okay. And then if anybody says anything like, hey, wait, before we do this, do you think that maybe this isn't the best nutritional decision to make for people who already are kind of in harm's way? That maybe we should say, hey, there's certain things that are not really food and we don't really need you to be able to buy those. Then they will say you're a racist, as though this has anything to do with race. Like, as there's no, there's not fat white people or something, right? There's big fat white people all over the place. Go to a trailer park. You'll see them. The trailer that leans a little bit, they're probably in there. If you see the trailer move as they go from one end to the other, you can be sure that's what's going on. This isn't a racial issue. This is a nutritional issue. We're all Homo sapiens. We all have the same basic dietary requirements, and sugar's not one of them. So that should enrage you. But, you know, I know there's people that, you know, they're not really going to be enraged by that either. And that's kind of messed up. Let's go on, though, because we're not done yet. What do you hear this one?
A mass increase in mental health disorders and even suicidal ideation from Ozempic. You just back up and ask, you know, this miracle drug is too good to be true. It's really coming through.
Wait, so you're saying there could be a downside? It's not perfect?
30% of people. but I want to say this, and I'm a libertarian. You know, I think people should be able to take Ozempic. I think most drugs should be legal, frankly. The problem is where the rubber really hits the road is there is an all-out assault to convince us that this is the appropriate drug. Again, this is the target market. This is why the stocks are popping and why Wall Street's going crazy. It's the biggest TAM, the biggest target market for any drug in American history. It's 80% of American adults. But it's being fast-tracked. You wouldn't believe this, but the American Academy of Pediatrics recently said that they recommend this as a first line of defense for teens. And the study basing that decision for the American Academy of Pediatrics to say that every obese or overweight teen, which is 50%, should take this drug, was a 68-week study. We had a 68-week study for a lifetime recommendation to 50% of teens in America to receive these injections.
So I guess...
I care less. I didn't say couldn't care less. I'm saying I care less about the fact that it was a 68-week study and more about the fact that a group of doctors who masquerade as an organization that are patient advocates will publicly state that you should take children who eat too much food, and instead of saying don't eat that, you should put them on a drug that has an average cost of $1,000 to $1,600 a month, an aggregate average of $20,000 a year, and say that this child should be on this drug for the rest of their life. There's some real insidious shit here beyond the obvious. Let's start out with this. If you come from a background of generational welfare, follow me on this. It is very difficult to extract yourself from this in the first place because you're being brought up by people who've lived on it their whole life, who were brought up by people who lived on it their whole life. And let's say it goes back to great grandma, to people that were by also people. So you're like a fourth generation, third generation welfare family. Incredibly difficult to break. But how do we fund a poor family's 14-year-old fat kid that they shouldn't even have a 14-year-old fat kid if they're poor? I've said this before. The fact that we have the most obese people in our country are poor. That tells you all kinds are wrong. So you put this 14-year-old on Ozempic, and you convince him and his mom or whoever else is looking after him, he needs this for the rest of his life. It's not his fault that he's fat, which is the truth used to sell a lie. It's society's fault this kid's fat. But he should be able to eat anything you want and not be fat like this. Look at the people that do it. There's like 20% of people left that apparently do that. Most of them probably don't eat this garbage, and that's why they're not fat. But he's going to need this. Now, this kid hits 18, 19 years old and old enough to kind of go out on their own. How do they afford a drug that's $1,200 a month if the government's not paying for it? Well, they just let the government continue to pay for it. So this is yet another thing in the antlion trap of don't get out of welfare. You see how that folds back into itself. So this is also a way to keep people on welfare forever. The drug company doesn't care who pays the bill for 20 grand a year. The drug company doesn't care. The government's giving them like 7 grand a year for $20,000 worth of drugs a year because they have literally like a quarter into making a vial. You see how this all works. But now let's look at the surface level issue, which is the one that should make your brain want to explode. If you check your blood pressure when you hear this and it doesn't go up, then you need to see if there's something wrong in your brain. We have doctors recommending that a fat kid, in lieu of changing their diet, go on a drug for 50, 60, 70, 80 years. This is $1,000 a month. With a straight face, looking you dead in the eye and telling you it's okay. And the brainwashing machine being so powerful that when they get done with their drug reps and their marketing campaigns and buying off doctors, most of the doctors making that prescription really think they're doing the right thing for their patient. There's two ways those doctors fall, and it's important to understand both of them. There are doctors that are so easily pushed in that direction, they're like, yeah, this is what to do. This is what the book says. It's what I went to school to learn how to do. It's what the industry says. It's what the study says. It's what the ADA says. It's what the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AAP, says. It's what everybody says, so I should do it. Then there's doctors that go, yeah, this is really wrong. But they don't trust their patient to make a lifestyle change. And they say, well, it's better than just letting them live the way they are without medication because they're not going to do what I tell them to anyway. And at least now I can make my BMW payments and my Porsche payments and buy my membership at the country club and send my daughter to Stanford. It's one or the other, because there really isn't a person smart enough to be a doctor to actually get through. I mean, there may be soon. We do enough DEI. God knows what we'll end up with the stupid people. Like, are we heading to idiocracy where the doctor's like, yo, Scro, don't worry. A lot of people that are tarded live really productive lives. I have an ex-girlfriend that's tarded. She's a pilot now. Like, are we headed to that? Maybe. But right now, if you can get into medical school, get through medical school, come out of medical school, get through your residency, and get certified by a board to practice medicine, you're not stupid. You may not be as smart as you think you are, but you are not stupid. And you have to be stupid to think that it's okay to take a 14-year-old fat kid and put them on an injectable medication once a week for the rest of their lives. Either that or you're a criminal. So you choose. Now, again, hopefully your blood is boiling a little bit right now, but I'm not done yet. I'm not done yet. I'm about to play you something that if you are a parent should make you want to strangle somebody. Don't go do it, but it's the reaction you should have when you hear what you're about to hear.
The standard of care for diabetes. You just step back. Why aren't doctors in giving their patients prescriptions for food interventions if they have prediabetes? Why aren't they giving them and prescribing them and allowing them to use their medically, tax advantage dollars to exercise? If you actually follow the science, that would be the correct medical intervention to reverse that. But we're so gaslighted by this. It's just not even batting an eye that it's just pill, pill, pill. Americans follow incentives. It's what we're trying to do. TrueMed is a doctor actually can write a note for exercise and food. And that actually can open up medical tax advantage dollars and other insurance dollars. Doctors could do that. But the second you get someone off the chronic disease treadmill, that's not a profitable patient. There's nothing more profitable for the pharmaceutical industry than, frankly, a sick kid. You imagine a kid with prediabetes, inevitably they're obese, inevitably they have hypertension, inevitably they have heart issues. They're going to be, like my mom, much earlier on just a ton of drugs, being told on each of those drugs that you're not curing anything. These are conditions you need to manage for life. So we're getting people, there's a war to get kids on that bandwagon. We need to have the moral clarity.
All right. Your child... I'm going to say our children, and I'm not a collectivist, you guys know that, but I do look at this next generation of kids that are young enough that they have a reasonable expectation that we, who are adults, will provide them a layer of protection. That's what I mean when I say our kids. Our children are now seen by the drug companies as patient zero in their financial analysis, that the best thing in the world that can happen to Pfizer or Merck or Johnson & Johnson or Eli Lilly or any of these companies is to put a child on a maintenance medication for the rest of their life. This is fascist economics at work. This would not work in a free society. You would not be able to do this. There is an entire situation at play here that makes this, and we've skipped it till now, and I'll hit it, and then we need to move on from this one. It's called regulatory capture. The way they're able to do all this is some genius got the idea when they started to put some real oversight on the pharmaceutical industry that we should have government agencies that oversee them and make sure that they don't do shit like this. And then somebody said, well, how are we going to pay for it? And somebody that said they were thinking like a free market person, who clearly wasn't, said, I know, we'll make them pay for their own regulation. They make lots of money. Let's have fees and fines and stuff like that. And then we can fund all the government oversight from the people that need to be overseen, which seems like a great idea until you actually do it. And then all of a sudden, the people inside places like NIH are like, well, if we actually put that company out of business, how much that's going to cost us? How many billions of dollars a year? Well, oh shit, we can't do that. And then once that gets locked in, then you start the rotational thing where we hire the person out of NIH into Purdue Pharma, and then we send them back into NIH, and then they go hold a cabinet position, and then they go work for Pfizer, and then they go work for Merck, and then they go back into a lobbying position, and then they go back into NIH or FDA. And that can't happen in an honest society, but we'll save that for later. But This is what you just heard from somebody inside the industry. And by the way, I recommend you listen to the whole thing if you can stand it. I gave you 5% of the things that should just make you want to rebel hard against all of this. This is the video that when we watched it, my wife said, we need that prepper community you're talking about. We need like 200 acres and only people we let in. And like Doc Kenberry says, if you're sick and fat and out of shape and you won't take care of yourself, you're not on my team and you don't get in and the whole world can go screw itself. My wife doesn't talk like that. It wasn't a prepper video. It wasn't economics. It was this. Understanding what's being done to us. For all the talk about the stabby stabs, right? So I don't get this video flagged or whatever. I see so many people talking about how dangerous it is and, you know, reposting things from like died suddenly or whatever. But they're like 400 pounds and they're eating Pizza Hut and Cheetos every day. You're not consistent if that's you. Please understand, yes, an animal-based diet is the way to go. Vegetables and animal-based foods, that's it. If you do that, you're going to get past 90% of this. Pretty much, though, do the exact opposite of everything the government says. And you'll be better off with some common sense. They also say, look both ways before you cross the street. You should keep doing that. So without that level of stupidity, if the government says use seed oils instead of animal fats, use animal fats, right? If the government says, hey, high fructose corn syrup is fine in moderation, you should hear, hey, heroin is fine in moderation, as though anybody has the willpower to use heroin regularly, intravenously in moderation. You don't. You don't. There's people that are functional heroin addicts. But no one has the ability to continuously use a drug like heroin in moderation. And no one has the ability to continuously consume high fructose corn syrup in moderation, especially in combination with artificial fats. So there you go. Let's move on. Let's talk about the Putin interview. I'm not going to be bringing anything up on screen for this one, but I wanted to hit this because there's something no one's saying. There are some people kind of making fun. And there are people that are more like in our world that are doing this, like Bitcoiners and stuff. Like, well, when did Bitcoin start? Well, see, back – and they go back into like – there used to be an abacus, and then it just kind of trails off and making a joke of how Putin went back to the Kiev Rus and all the way back into the 800 AD period to explain the entire history of Russia. It's like the first 30 minutes of the interview, and – I think it's very valuable, but I kind of wish it wasn't there. I think what Tucker needs to do is break this interview up into 10 to 15 minute bites and publish those bites so that people can take bites of it. Cause it is a hard interview to watch all the way through. I did because it's important. I realized something about 15 minutes into it though, when I was getting frustrated, Tucker was getting frustrated. I'm sorry. He said something like, I don't understand what that has to do with the question I asked you. And Putin's like, if you wait, you'll understand. I know it seems boring, but when I listened to the whole thing and I really took it in, it is a very thoughtful presentation. You don't have to agree with it to see it as thoughtful. Okay? In other words, you're asking me a question with complete ignorance of the history of this part of Europe and Asia and how everything got to where it is. And how old the tensions are and where the tensions are and how they came about and whether or not you agree with my conclusion. If you're going to understand it, you need to know this. That is being thoughtful. And this is why it will fall on deaf ears with the American public in general, because the American public is not thoughtful and because your government has done everything that it can to ensure that you're not thoughtful. And so what you want to do is pick up the right foam finger with the number one on it and wave it. That's like the incentive. Like the guy that we just listened to from the pharma industry said Americans follow incentives. That's the incentive they have created for you. Pick a team, put your foam finger up, and never put it down. Yep, we're number one. We're number one. I don't care if you're a liberal. They don't care if you're a conservative. Just God forbid, don't be a free independent thinker. That's the worst thing you can do as far as they're concerned. So when somebody brings a very thoughtful, not even an argument, a thoughtful explanation, this is how we got to where we are. Most people do not wish to hear it. And even if they try to listen, you'll find them turning themselves off of it. Like they're not really paying attention anymore. And so I think that in some levels, that interview was a failure for Putin not so much for Tucker because of that. And, you know, like, am I sad about that? Not really. I'm sad that my country is that stupid. Right. And I'm not saying you should agree with everything the man said, but I'm saying if you can't look at that, listen to that. And first of all, I would like to ask you a question here. If you said to any living person who has served as president of the United States, so we've got Carter, Reagan's gone, Bush 2's gone, Carter, Clinton, Bush 2, Obama, Trump, Biden are still alive, right? Is that right? Okay. Let's resurrect Reagan and Bush 1. Let's say from everybody from Jimmy Carter to Joe Biden is alive. And let's say unlike Biden and unlike probably Carter at this point, and Carter you can forgive, dude's 99 years old, right? Has their faculties fully as they did when they were serving. And you said, explain the history of the United States for me beginning in 1492 and how this country was settled and formed to today. Do you think one of them could have given you the explanation that Putin was able to give that goes back like another almost like, what, 800 years? Do you think one of them could have done it? I don't think if you put them all in a room together, they could collectively give you that history of the United States over a much shorter period. So that alone impresses me. But Putin lied in that interview. I only heard Vivek being able to do that, says Transylvania Fire. I think Vivek Ramaswamy, I don't know if it would be as detailed, but I think he probably knows more. And that's why he didn't get the votes. And that's why people that supported Vivek are like, I don't understand why he did so poorly. Because it doesn't work. We work with like Hector Macho Camacho, right? Hector Mountain Dew Macho Camacho from Idiocracy. Woo, number one, not sure it's going to fix it all. Let's go. Woohoo! You know, that's America. We've become that mainly because of the shit. That's why we started with what we did. When you deprive people of real nutrition and you give them a screwed up education on top of it for multiple generations, this is what you get. This is what you get. All these, Vivek is a plant. Go away. Go away. Stop your stupid shit. Not everything's a plant. Not everything's a freaking conspiracy. Sometimes people just say what they think. Sometimes that just happens. He's a plant. A plant to do what? To lose? Good. He did that. He could have just been fat Krispy Kreme Christie and done the same thing. Let it go, guys. Not everything you need to latch onto like a conspiracy. That's also all of this manipulation in infiltrating your brain. And even if he is, so what? Who cares? Who gives a shit? He lost. He's not going to ever be probably elected to anything. So why do you care? Because you have to like find this one thing to grab onto instead of understanding what's being done to you. So I'm worried about stupid shit. You know, the other stupid shit I saw recently, this is an aside here, didn't plan to talk about today. I put up this video. It's Joe Biden. And it's from 2019 and just a couple weeks ago. And it's Biden saying that the new video is between now and whenever people are going to know that the reason the border is not secure is because of Donald Trump and his MAGA Republican friends. Okay. And then there's I spliced it together and there's Joe Biden while he's campaigning saying the first thing he would do is search to the border all the people that need to come into the country. But the big difference is this dramatic decline. Like Biden wasn't exactly at the top of his game in 2019, but it looks like two different people from a standpoint of presentation. Like one is kind of some energy and some pep and somewhat articulate for Joe Biden anyway. And the other one's like mumbling with food in his mouth and probably crapped his pants. But you know what people said? That's a double. I'm sorry, you're stupid. I don't care if you saw a picture of his earlobe. You need to understand what happens to people when they age and shit stretches and they get funny man ears and people glue their earlobes in so they don't sit like this when they're talking or whatever. If I was going to create a double for the president of the United States, who I'm trying to convince people is not mentally incompetent, I wouldn't put a person in there who's mentally incompetent. I would put somebody that could be a little bit articulate. Like, use your God-given brain, as my father-in-law used to say. Start thinking beyond. You saw somebody post something on TikTok or Twitter or X or whatever the fuck it is. Stop that shit. Anyway, moving on. Putin lied. Let me tell you where Putin lied. I'm not going to say it's the only place, but this is where Putin absolutely lied. He was talking about, as the satellite republics like Lithuania and Ukraine broke off from the Soviet Union, and he said the Soviet Union chose to allow that to happen. In fact, he chose to kind of like, go ahead, guys, which is true. Then inside those satellite republics were areas that were historically Russia, which Donbass is one, the whole contested area inside Ukraine right now. Doesn't make Putin right, but it does. It's the truth. The Donbass region was Russia. And when Ukraine was formed by the Soviet Union, when it was taken in, the Ukrainian border was extended into Russia so that part of Ukraine actually was Russia territory, like Russia proper. And that's led to this. Now, where's the lie? He said, for some unknown reason. And he said that several times. For some unknown reason, this decision was made. Go listen to it if you doubt me. It's not an unknown reason, and Putin knows full well what the reason was, because I do, and if I know it, he does. When that was done, the Russians decided we're going to take all these satellite republics as part of our Soviet Union, and we're going to give them a certain amount of autonomy. We'll come back to that in a second. Being that the case, we'd like some loyalists in there, so they extended the borders into Russia proper, pushed that out into these new republics, so they had a base of ethnic Russians, and in the case of Ukraine, they also had a lot of ethnic Hungarians, quite a few ethnic Romanians, and quite a few ethnic Poles, because Ukraine wasn't a country. It was a region. I'm sorry if you don't like that. And my family's from fucking Ukraine, so go stick it up your ass unless you know for a fact that I'm wrong and you can show me where I'm wrong. Okay? So my family left this place turn of the last century, and then several other parts of our family left leading up to Holodomor, which was the starvation. So I have some historical familial knowledge of what's going on there. But that's why. So when Putin said for some unknown reason, multiple, he was lying out of his face. So don't think that I can't point out when somebody's wrong because you think that I'm on their side. What is my side? I'll say this one more time because it doesn't really matter to what we're talking about today. My side in this Ukraine-Russia conflict is it's not our business. That's it. That's my entire position. And this is where people have a very, because you're supposed to get the phone finger and pick a side. If I was pro-Putin, you could hate me, but you could understand it, right? And if I was pro-Ukraine, then you could love me and you could understand it. Or you could hate me and understand it. We polarized. Pro-Putin, Russia's right. Pro-Ukraine, Zelensky's right. To say there's two people here, it's a deep, long, inborn conflict. It's about a line on a map, no matter what anybody else says. It's a line on a map that's been in question many times throughout history. It's not something we're going to fix. Us touching it will make it worse. We should stay out of it and let regional conflicts resolve themselves, as they always historically have. Then you don't know what to do with that. So what do people do? Well, the people who are pro-Ukraine, who want to just keep giving money to Zelensky so he can pay bureaucratic pensions, by the way, with it, say, two of Putin. And the people that are pro-Russia are like, one of us, one of us. No, I'm anti-war. And no nation benefits from a protracted war, so I don't want to protract the war. See how simple that is? Real, real easy to understand. The Ukraine needs to figure out their own problems. Hey, Alabama says they don't need our money or anything else. No, they don't. Every dollar we give to Ukraine at this point probably kills at least one more Ukrainian young man. And now it's like old men. And by the way, Ukraine is now, Zelensky fired his top general for being too aggressive, which Zelensky made him be, because we wanted results for our money with the offensive that failed miserably and cost about 100,000 lives and about 200,000 injuries. Most of those injuries permanently incapacitating. And so now they put this new general in charge. He's going to switch to a defensive tactic, which there is no Russian offensive. So I guess they're going to stare at each other and fly drones at each other for a while. So this looks, and see, people get really weird about this because you think there is a Nazi problem in Ukraine, but I'm putting that on the shelf for this discussion. Ukraine right now looks a lot like Germany with like 18 to 12 months left in the war. like anybody inside the apparatus that's not at the very top, that's not subject to manipulation and control, knows it's over, but they can't say it out loud. And so they keep regurgitating new strategies, new wonder weapons, whatever. It looks exactly like, I guarantee you, Hitler's top generals knew the war was lost. And to take the Nazi out of it, let's imagine that Germany was on the right side of the war. They weren't, but let's say they were. You're still lost. And that's where this is. Let's move on from there. This should scare you. It probably won't scare most people because they don't understand what it really means. New report out. 2/3 of Canadian and American renters are in unaffordable housing situations. I do have links to all this stuff in the show notes today. They'll be up on the audio side about 30 minutes after we end the live stream. If you're watching this live, link is right down there in the video notes for you. People listening to it, just look up today's episode 3447. You can find all the links. Anyway, but what this article basically says, the gist of it is about 2 out of 3 people that live in the United States or Canada, their rent or mortgage payment exceeds 30% of their income. It doesn't say that. You have to do math to get the number. It's a very interesting number. So what they said is anybody paying more than 30% of their income to housing expenses, and they base this on gross income, by the way, is in an unaffordable situation. Well, where does that come from? If I'm a landlord and you apply to rent a property from me, and I want to say no because I don't think you can afford it, I have to do it with math. The government of both countries has come down with a number. I don't know if the United States has increased that number or Canada's invoked here, so maybe they're using the Canadian number. But the number in the United States used to be 25%. I remember from when I got my first, you know, apartment here in Texas, and I've had to fill out a traditional rental application instead of just knocking on a door and going, yeah, I can afford rent with cash. When I was a kid, that's how I rented my first place. When I got here, I had to do it, and it basically said, unless you make at least if this rent exceeds 25% of your gross income, which is dumb because I don't get my gross income, I get my net income, then you can't rent here. And I was like, geez, I don't want to spend $1 out of every $4 I make just on rent. How am I going to pay for electric and food and everything else? But that was the number that they said you had to hit. Well, either they raised that number to 30, but I did check. It's definitely 30 in Canada. So all these people that wrote this up did was say, well, this exceeds the government's limit for how much of your money you can spend. So that number's actually bigger. And if you want to put some numbers to it, a family that makes about $50,000 a year would end up with, of their gross income, about $3,000 a month to pay for everything else. Car, gas, food, whatever the kids need, clothing, maintenance, all of it. $3,000. You have, when I started this show 16 years ago, you could live okay on $3,000 a month, including housing. You can't live well on $3,000 a month right now, especially if you have any kid. If you're alone, sure. But if you have kids or something, you can't live on that. Like, these are people that are at the edge of the skin of their teeth. It takes a flick in the forehead to send them into the abyss. And most of them, how did they get there? They were able to get into that property when the rent was lower and their income was higher. And somewhere along the way, those two things shifted. And now they're underwater with it. And most of them are getting by at least doing some credit card every month. All they need to do is lose one, especially a family, one side loses a job, they're going to lose the ability to live where they are, or cut and pay, somebody loses overtime, or you max the credit cards out and now the payment pushes you out of there. In other words, this is one of those dominoes that it's going to take one thing to flick. And you'll have a cascade that looks a lot like 2007, 2008, 2009, except it's going to be much worse this time. Because at least in 2008, the person that could no longer afford to live where they were could find a cheaper place to go, and they could afford food. Have you priced food lately? I mean, I know the government keeps telling you inflation's down, inflation's down. Inflation has not gone down. The rate at which it goes up has decreased. So when they say inflation is 3%, Well, you're ignoring what happened for 4 years. You're ignoring multiple years of double-digit inflation. And now the 3% is compounding on the past 3-4 years. So a 3% inflation rate today is way worse than a 3% inflation rate in, let's say, 2018. Way worse, because it's compounding interest. They teach you this because they want you to be a good little drone and put money in the 401k plan and fund all their bullshit, right, with money that's locked up for your own good. They explain compounding returns to you when it benefits you. But when they do not benefit you, they don't want you to know anything about it. Don't you understand? Everything they tell you, if you put $100 a month in, starting when you're 18, you'll retire with $4 million, right? Yeah, if you invest it right, okay, yeah, sure. But how does that happen? Well, because all the money you put in the first year compounds with all the money that you put in the second year, and then the return compounds on that. And then all the money you got on the return compounds all the new contributed money. And every year, the amount that it's compounding on goes up. So your ROI of 10% per annum or whatever gets bigger and bigger over time. When the money's coming out of your ass, whether it be with credit card interest rates or mortgage interest rates or taxation or any of it, it all works the other direction. So we are in a very shitty situation right now economically in this country. It is so much worse than, oh, we have $34 trillion in debt. That's terrible. How about we have about a $1 trillion interest payment on the debt now? Somebody said that was going to happen. Somebody wrote a book, gave it away for free back about 2012, 2013, called The Real Truth About Money, and said in that book, by the early 2020s, our interest on the debt will exceed $1 trillion. And everybody said he was crazy. Don't know who he is. He probably farms ducks. Yeah. That's where we are now. We are going to spend more money on interest on the debt than we did for the Department of Defense. And the fact checkers say, well, you know, the thing is, we're going to keep increasing the defense budget, so it's not exactly true. What could we do for the people of this country if we actually tried with $1 trillion a year? If it was actually put to really good use, like making housing more affordable, getting regulations out of the way and doing it in a way where we don't actually hurt the planet, feeding hungry people in a path towards self-sufficiency, like we could probably fix every problem that we have as well as can be done. I do not teach utopia thinking. I don't believe in utopia. I think we will always have problems. Even Jesus said the poor would always be with you, right? Right? You will always have the poor among you. But we could create a society with that amount of money alone that anybody who wanted a better life could have a reasonable path to acquiring it very, very easily, honestly. But we won't, because that's not what we do, because we have a fiat system that results in fiat food, fiat education, fiat everything, peak fiat. That's where we're sitting at right now. This is where you think I'm going to go into a Bitcoin conversation. Not yet. Not yet. I know a couple of you wanted when you were calling for it when we started up today. Now, I want to talk about something else. Do you know that if you look at a global index for corruption, not so surprising, the two nations that will be on like the very high list of corruption would be Ukraine and Russia. Just saying. Very highly corrupt societies. But the United States, we rank very low in corruption. Well, how's that work? I mean, personally, I think just Chicago, Illinois might be one of the most corrupt major cities in the world. But how do we rank low in corruption? I'm going to tell you a story. Back when I used to work with Neil Franklin, guy out of Britain, really good entrepreneur, really wonderful guy, good friend, great partner. We built a bunch of stuff together. He turned me on to a lot of British television. And he turned me on to a thing. I think it was either Mitchell and Webb or Trigger Happy TV that this was on. I think it was Mitchell and Webb. And one of the skits was this guy from Holland or Netherlands or Amsterdam. It was Amsterdam. And he was a cop, and he was there with his gay cop lover guy in the car, and they're making a big joke out of it back when you could do that without being, you know, flogged and canceled. And he said, we used to have a big problem with the drugs, but now we legalized it and there is no problem, right? And I can't do the accent the way the guy could do it, right? They legalized the drugs, so now they don't have a drug problem anymore because they're legal. This is how corruption has been low, like really low in the United States. We legalized corruption. We did it in two ways, lobbying and regulatory capture that we already covered today. When I can pick someone I want elected, get together all my billionaire friends, if I'm a billionaire, and say, let's do this thing. And they say, well, how do we buy influence with this person? Oh, we're going to form a super PAC. And if we want to run something they don't, then we just say it's from the super PAC. And if they want to be directly part of it, they can say they approved our message. But either way, we're going to be the one that gets them taken as a serious candidate and gets them elected. And when they want to get reelected, they'll need our money again. And all the billionaire friends, if they weren't familiar with this system, would be like, oh, whoa, 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 wait a minute, Jack. You telling me we're going to buy influence with the president of the United States or a United States senator or the governor of a state or the district attorney of a state level DA, a federal process, like we're going to buy that influence and we're not going to go to jail. And I'm like, yeah, guys, listen, we got it all worked out. We got laws passed by the people that we're going to buy influence from that say, as long as we do it this way, it's okay. Just think about that. You live in one of the most corrupt societies that's ever existed. Buying influence today is the easiest thing that you can do. If you go back and you read Ross Perot's book from when he ran for president the second time, he talks about how the Japanese did this with trucks. So, you know, obviously this is before they started building most trucks that are like Toyotas are built in the United States today. They actually used to build Japanese vehicles in Japan, though. I know that's crazy. They used to do that. And we have emission standards. And we have emission standards specifically for imported vehicles because domestic manufacturers don't want to be outcompeted with. It's funny now. The Chevys are built in Korea and the Toyotas are built in, you know, like Louisiana. But whatever. And the Dodges are built in Mexico. It's crazy, isn't it? But what the Japanese did, and this was very smart of them, because we're the one with the corrupt system. You just work the system that's corrupt, right? State of jujitsu. The Japanese bribed, through political contributions to our senators and congressmen, they bribed them to regulate their small trucks, which was mostly what they imported at the time, as cars. Right? So the small trucks were regulated as cars. They got them regulated as trucks. It was a certain gross vehicle weight that, like, you know, the little Toyotas were under that weight, so they were considered a car. So they got the federal government to say, no, they're not cars, they're trucks. The trucks had a higher emission standard. It made it cheaper to import the trucks by importing them as trucks versus cars. But they then manipulated the same people into saying, well, they're trucks when they're being shipped in for import purposes. But once they're on U.S. soil and rolling around, then we defer to what the states classify as a truck versus a car, and they turn back into cars. I'm sorry, they turn back into cars again. So they were able to basically work both sides of the system directly. And I screwed it up a little bit because it's so confusing because it's so crazy. They were able to get the rating they wanted during import and after import, and they weren't the same thing. And they were able to get and what Perot says in this book when he interviewed the lobbyists for the Japanese, because obviously the Japanese they hire people here in the States, like former congressmen, to do this for them. When he interviewed those lobbyists under conditions of anonymity, of course, they said that what the Japanese were most surprised by is how easy it was, how easy we sell out. Now, that's going back 35 years. You think anything's gotten better? Because if you do, I got some shit to sell you. One of them's a bridge. Let's move on. I'll bring this up. I'm not going to play it because, again, it would do no good for anybody that is not sitting here. I'm going to just, to give you some scale, expand this. So this is some lady in some foreign country petting a lynx. And what the hell, I'll play a little bit of it so you can see her kissing on it and all. And then we'll come back and talk about the point of it.
Потом наложишь, да? I love you. I love you.
Okay, so for those who didn't see it, this is this lady. She loves the cat. She's kissing all over its face. It's playfully chewing on her face. But what made me actually pay attention to this wasn't the video of itself. The person that originally did it said, it's all fun and games until the giant murder floof eats your face off and uses your corpse as a chew toy. But then Backwoods Engineer, who I've had follow me on Twitter for years, said, just connecting the dots. Remember that woman who had the big monkey as a pet and it tore her face off? What is the deal with women not recognizing exotic pets as dangerous? Is their emotional protection so strong it cuts off their ability to apprehend danger? Explains a lot of abused women, too. Here's what I said about it, and I think this is spot on, and I'm not giving men a pass. We're going to come back and talk about how men do the same thing in a different realm. It's called compartmentalization, and women are worse about it than men. All these bad things happen here, but not over here where I am. Same reason women are more likely to oppose gun ownership and carry, etc. It isn't they are unaware. They just believe that the gated community they live in is safe. Be that gate real or a metaphor. It is really that simple. Men do it too, and they lower their testosterone level, and the lower their testosterone levels, the more they equalize with women. And what I'm talking about there about men equalizing with women is on the macro that we're talking about with things like having a tiger as a pet. That was the guy that built the whole empire on that. So men will do it too. And in that way, it is usually the soy boys, the low T men that do that. And we'll get to beating up men in a second. Let's talk about how women do this though. And this is the common objection you hear from women that you don't hear from men. Well, we should get a gun, right? The man says we should get a gun in case somebody breaks in our house. And a woman will say something like that. Who would break into our house? If it's never happened and never happened to anybody she knows, it seems like a reasonable question. Well, why would this happen to us? Well, look at all the break-ins that were in our county. Yeah, but those people live over there. Bill, we live in a gated community. There's a guard out there and everything. You know, and there's like 1,000 houses in the gated community, as though none of the people that live in those houses might be a criminal. Criminals are actually, you know, stopped by rent-a-cops or something. Like, I'm sure that neighborhood probably is safer, but it's not immune to anything going wrong. And it's usually women that take this approach. If you have a couple and one of them's opposed to the family owning a gun, 9 times out of 10, it's the woman. I'm sorry, ladies. I know many of you in this audience who do not think this way. Good for you. I'm saying at large. It's called compartmentalization. And it is something we do to intellectually, mentally, and stress level protect ourselves. We all do it. And that is, there are, and this is why I don't like doing these shows, because if you just want me to tell you things that are dangerous, I can go all day, all night, and all next week. Like, we are surrounded by things that can harm us and kill us. Malicious things and just natural things. You know, in, I think it was 2012, we did SHOT Show. We've been invited a bunch of times. We finally went. And while we were in Vegas, my wife and I don't do gambling and late night partying and shit like that. So we like went to like the cool places to hike in the desert and stuff like that. And we went to this one place and my wife is getting kind of close to like a serious like death. You're going to die if you fall off. And I'm like, get the hell away from there. She's like, you're overreacting. I'm like, no, I'm not. Again, compartmentalization, not me, right? And we get back to our hotel room that evening. And we sit down and turn the TV on, and there's a news report. And Dorothy goes, we were standing right there today. And I'm like, you mean when I told you you could fall down the hole? She goes, yes, somebody fell down the hole. So somebody let that mindset, well, not me, this is a tourist place. I mean, surely they wouldn't let us in here if it was dangerous. And for one second, for a millisecond, they defied natural law and they died. And in general, with things like that, women tend to be worse. Now, when it comes to thrill seeking and risk, especially young men, they do it too. Well, it's okay for me to be an asshole and walk around. Like, they actually get more dangerous, but they're cognizant of the risk and they're getting a thrill from it. So when I say men do it too, that's not really what I'm talking about. But it is the reason that 90% of snake bites in America that are not from people who own venomous snakes, like they're not herpetologists that keep them in a collection and it's a risk and they know it and try to avoid it. 90% of people bit by venomous snakes in the United States that are bit, we say, in the wild, which might be your backyard, are young men, age 15 to 35, and the primary place they are bit is the lower arms and the hand. Why? Because they fucked with the snake. If you get bit on the hand, anything short of you reached into a flower pot, it was in there and you didn't know it, you fucked with the snake. That's how you got bit on the hand. You fucked with it. So men do it too. But where do men do it way worse than women? Medically. That's why. That's where we really screw. That's where we compartmentalize. You should monitor your blood pressure. Well, not me. But if Bill has high blood, you're like, Bill, take your, don't we do that too? So we just have this aspect in our lives. We just do it. We just manifest it in general by sex in different locations. But it's important to recognize that pattern, not so you can point out when somebody like this moron who's petting a lynx, right? Like, not just so you can say, oh, look how stupid this behavior is. And I've got the video with no sound up with it rolling through for people to look at, right? Like, so that you can see it in yourself when you're doing it. So when you think, well, I can keep, you know, eating this way for a while longer, it'll be okay. I know this is killing people. I know that it's bad to eat seed oils, but, you know, this tastes really good and I need something to eat today. We do the same shit, guys. You got to start separating yourself from that type of behavior, because no good comes from that type of behavior. This is exactly an example of doing stupid things in stupid places with stupid people. Don't do that. All right, moving on. I want to talk real quick about our expectation to fix the problem. And it's all the problems that we talked about today are actually caused by our expectation of how the problem gets fixed. When I was listening to the interview that I led off with segments of from Tucker Carlson with the pharmaceutical guy, the one person who kept popping back in my head is a guy that I disagree with a lot, by the way. But I think he does some really good books, and I think some of his points are extremely valid. And of all things, I would hope that some of you have learned from me that you can learn from a person who you disagree with. And not just a different view. So, like, yes, you can learn. I believe this, and you believe that, and I better understand your view into my thing, so I better understand the thing, even though I still disagree with everything that you say about it. We can have that respectful debate or disagreement, and we can learn from each other and by learning about other people and their views. I don't mean that way. I mean, you can have a person that, like, 80% of what they say you think is bullshit, but the 20% of the rest may be things that you need to learn, even if you're right about the 80%. So one of the things, and there's actually one of his books is called this, that Kunstler talks about, is Too Much Magic. Now, he's an apocalyptic fellow. He believes that the prepper fiction world that so many of the books we read in this space are about is really going to happen. And it's inevitable. There is no way out of it. We will have economic, technological, every form of collapse known to man. And we will go back to living, you know, where the most sophisticated people live, like the Amish of today. Like, that's it. And I don't agree with that at all. But his reasoning is that we believe too much in magic. Now, he doesn't mean David Copperfield magic or, you know, Gandalf the Wizard, you know, magic staffs or whatever. He means the belief in technology and science to fix all our problems is a form of magic because you believe in a thing that's not real. I think he's right about that. I think that most of the solutions to our problems are not something that we can fix with a new technology. If there's a technology, most of the solutions are in old technology. Here's the reality about nature. David Holmgren, I'm not going to quote him directly because I can't remember the exact quote, but said that we need to understand that nature is not, and David Holmgren is co-founder of permaculture, it is not just a benevolent mother, a spirit that provides for us. It's also a great destroyer. The same mother nature that provides the beautiful meadow that the deer live in, that you can go back with your spear and your at ladle and pretend to be a caveman, stab the deer and live a life as a hunter-gatherer. That same mother nature is responsible for the hurricane that kills you, okay? Or the forest fire that burns your village, if not you and your kids with it. Nature is harsh. And what I take from that is actually that nature doesn't give a flying shit about your feelings, your goals, your emotion, your desires, or your technology. Nature is undefeated and always will be. Nature will have the fungi eat our bones in the forest floor if we eradicate ourselves and go extinct as a species, and it will roll right on through until our sun goes nova and burns up the earth. That's a natural process, and somewhere some life will be reborn in some other solar system, and the process will continue. We are irrelevant to the process. So if that's the case, we better understand the process. We better understand the process. And the process is one of abundance. There is no shortage of food in the world, even though we have lots of starving people. We know there's damn sure no shortage of money in the world. In fact, the surplus of money is the problem. If you want abundant everything, you need scarce money. If you want scarce critical needs, then you have abundant money. That's how it works. There's all you get on Bitcoin today, those of you that waited for it. Bitcoin is scarce money that can create a world of abundance, but it needs a lot more than just scarce money. That's just one piece of the incentive process. Our world is of such abundance that I believe if an alien species actually came here, and I don't think any have, okay, I don't buy into it. I think it's all a psyop. It's designed to take your eye off the ball. Because you have to take your ball off the eye off the ball for a fraction of a second, even a slow pitch softball is all it takes, and you're going to miss the ball, right? So, but if an alien race really did come here and follow Star Trek's like non-intervention principle and just kind of set up in a cloaked ship and observe us, it wouldn't take them very long to realize this is a sick society. And I don't just mean diseases. They would say, my God, this planet is so full of abundance. Look at all these poor people. And it wouldn't matter if those aliens had a socialist bent or a capitalist bent. They would come to the same conclusion. These people don't know how to utilize their resources. When there's something in such abundance, if you're a capitalist, you say, well, the best way to fix this is to empower a market-based economy that makes this incredibly abundant thing available, and competition will keep it inexpensive. And if you're a socialist, you try the flawed tactic of let's distribute it, but at least you do that, you try. And I don't know if these aliens were some sort of angelic race that actually wasn't led by greed, maybe they could pull it off. I'm not going to say it's impossible. I don't think it's best for us, but I'm not going to say it's impossible. But one way or another, it'd be like there's hungry people here and lots of food here. Why don't we teach the hungry people to make food, or get the food to the hungry people? Or get the hungry people to the food? Or look, there's all these fat people here and all these undernourished people here. Why don't we just move the people and let them eat each other's food for a while until they kind of self... Like, they would just... Like, they would think we've lost our minds, and we have, collectively. We've lost our minds. Nature is full of abundance. There's no shortage of food. There's no shortage of air. There's no shortage of water. There's no shortage of land that can be farmed. There's no shortage of land that can produce food, even if it's not what we think of as farming. There's no shortage of anything from a material standpoint for the population that we have. Yet we have people that live in abject poverty, and we have people that live in this country in what we consider poverty that would be considered royalty in other parts of the world. But no matter where you are, unless you are among the percentile that is a fraction of a percentile of one, on some way you are controlled by a system, even if you do. You're just a slave with nice chains. Your chains are gold and you polish them. And this guy's chains are like rusty iron and you're above him in the hierarchy. Well, how do we get there? We get there through something called artificial scarcity. And what I want to bring up on the screen right now, very briefly, are diamonds really that scarce? So we pay a lot of money for a little crystal rock, a little piece of carbon that was pressed together under heat because it's really clear and really pretty, and some guy cut it into something and made it look like a crystal. Now we can take things that are just as clear and just as beautiful, like glass, and make them look exactly like that, or something like a cubic zirconium, and make it look, in fact, we can make it look better. Every way we judge a diamond, as far as flaws and lack of flaws and clarity or color, if we have a colored diamond, like we can make a synthetic gem or a glass gem or a zirconium gem that's better, that sells for a few bucks. But the diamond might sell for $10,000. Are diamonds scarce? Kelly says no, and he's right. That's what this article is about. There's a link to it if you want to read it. De Beers made them scarce. So what happened is around the 1930s and 40s and 50s specifically, as mining technology got better, realized there's a lot of diamonds. And most of them are in South Africa. And there's even one mine in South Africa that you can literally, I saw this on 2020 in the 80s. You can take a bucket on a rope, a couple hundred foot of rope, throw it, it looks like a stripping hole that you mine coal out of. It looks like all gravel and shale on its side. You throw the bucket down there and drag the bucket up the side of the hill, and something like 10% of the stuff that ends up in the bucket is diamonds. And like half of those are good enough to be cut and put into the marketplace. Not scarce. But what De Beers did is they bought up all the supply, and then they used it to exhort control over jewelry dealers and said, hey, let's explain to you how this, you should go along with this because it's your best interest to do so. And then they came up with this nonsensical idea that like a man should spend 2 months' salary or whatever it is on a ring to give his to be wife instead of like, oh, I don't know, using it for a down payment on a house. This goes back to the dowry, which was originally paid to the bride's father, right? Like basically we're buying the woman from the guy, but now it's like you're giving the woman this token to prove your worth when that worth could go into your marriage instead of your wedding. But how was it done? The illusion of scarcity. And when things are scarce, we have conflicts over them. So this is what I mean. Do you know that there was a time in human society when wars were fought over things like pepper, cinnamon, salt? There was a time when men who killed other men had part of their salary paid in salt. In fact, the root of the word salary is salt. Yeah. So men killed other men for fucking salt. And those of you who don't like the F word, I don't have a better word to say that. To look back at my species history and say there was a time when you could hire a young man like me who joined the military when I was young. So I was game. You could have hired me into the military as a Roman, put a sword and a shield in my hand, trained me how to fight, and I would have went off believing I was doing my duty to my country and my fellow man, and I would have stabbed in the heart and murdered another man so that the people that pay me could control the distribution of salt. If that's not a call for the word fuck, I don't know what is. Have you ever seen in your life, or your grandparents' life, or even your great-grandparents' life, a man spill blood of another man over salt? And the answer is you haven't. And no living human, thank God, ever has. Why? Why don't people, like, does salt not perform a whole shitload of vital functions? If you take away all salt from a human being, will it not eventually kill them? You need, I know they don't eat too much salt. Again, whatever the government says, don't listen to it. Either do the opposite or at least make your own mind up, right? But if you had no salt, you'll die. Now, it's pretty hard to not get any salt. There's salt in pretty much everything to some level. But if you were able to like make sure that everything a human being ate was devoid of salt, none, eventually you're going to die. It's a necessary element in your body. You need salt. But yet no one kills anybody for it because it's abundant and cheap. So now let's look at something going on today with inflation and everything. We see all these videos and people are out and they're stealing shit, and they're stealing like one or two items in mass. So you don't see the person going through the supermarket in general. This does happen too, but in general with a shopping cart, acting like they're just buying their weekly groceries and then walking out the door with them. Have you noticed that? That's not really what's going on with these smash and grabs and flash mobs and stuff like that. That's not what they're doing. You see one dude go in, walks around and finds something heavy in the store, beats the shit out of the lock case where they keep the Gillette razor blades, loads the entire shopping cart up with Gillette razor blades. The 2X minimum wage employees might say something, but as soon as the guy looks at him like, I'm going to beat you to death with this pipe, they just like, it ain't worth it, man. They know if they call the cops ain't going to do shit. And the guy runs out with a laundry a grocery basket full of razor blades or diapers or something like that. Now, do you need a razor blade to survive? No. We don't need it to survive, right? Do a lot of people use razor blades on a regular basis because they need to be well-groomed for their job or whatever? Yes. Okay. Do you think the man who stole every single package of Gillette razor blades out of that case is like, you know what? I'm good now, man. I got Gillette razor blades for the rest of my life. And I don't need to steal any more Gillette razor blades. I'll go steal something else. He doesn't do that. What does he do with the razor blades? He sells them probably to some fence that sits in the middle of a distribution system. Then that distribution system sells them to people that buys them. And they've gone from, you know, I don't know. I use an electric razor when I shave, right? So I don't even know what blades cost. I know they're expensive. But, you know, say that a pack of razor blades is like $12 now. And again, I don't know what they are. And the dude that's buying the razor blades is like, this is highway robbery, but I like to shave with a razor blade, and I like it to be a comfortable shave. So he's the one buying the razor blades for $4 or $5 a pack instead of 12 from the store, which is what creates the entire cycle. So the dude that steals them, he's obviously a thief. He'll obviously steal. He's not worried about the plight of the common man not being able to afford a razor blade. He's stealing the thing that's profitable. Well, why is it profitable? Because it's expensive and somebody's willing to pay for it if they can get it for less. Why is that person willing to do that? Most of the people buying that product, the end customer, are not the people that would go steal it. Otherwise, they wouldn't buy it. See, this requires you to think at a higher level, something they don't want you to do. Well, why is he willing to do that? Because he can't afford it anymore. We created an artificial scarcity of something like a Gillette razor blade. Then we put it behind a locked cabinet. It has now the dude that's willing to go into the gray area a little bit, not willing to steal himself, but he's also thinking like, if I'm buying some razor blades from my buddy Brad for $4 a pack, if he gets caught, he might have a problem, but I'm just like, I just thought he was selling me. Like, they know that nothing's really going to happen to them. They probably don't like it. But there's a point where people start to like go, so I need to figure out some way to live. I can't afford rent. I barely can afford food for my kids. Well, we create this artificial scarcity. Now, there's no need for it. How many of you out there use an electric razor and you buy new blades for it like once every 2 years? How many of you out there use an old school razor that you just pop a blade into a regular blade and it works just fine. How many of you have learned to use a straight razor and a strop and you know, you're good for decades with one razor? Like, there's ways around this, but we've conditioned people to think they need these things. And then we created an artificial scarcity. And when they put up that place where they lock all the shit up, there's also people like, I don't even give a shit about this anymore. Like, it's not worth it. Like, you get two things. Like, people either buy from the secondary market because your buddy Brad just hands them to you. You don't have to wait for somebody that's going to take 15 minutes to come open the locked cabinet to get shampoo or razor blades, for God's sake, right? But it's also going to cost you a third of the price. So that is what we did. We created a scarcity, and then we made it appear greater by locking it in. So how do we fix it? Well, we start building abundance. Every solution to all these problems is about building abundance. And the first place we should build abundance is food. And then we need to understand something, what we mean when we say that. We do not have a shortage of food in the United States of America. I'm going to confine it just to America. If you're overseas, you know, it applies to you too. But I'm going to stick, most of my audience is America, so I'm going to stick here for the end. We have more food in America than we need. Very few people in America who don't want to go hungry. Like, we have people that are living on the street and they still get 3 squares a day because they figured out which shelters to go to. Welfare, free food. People that work for a living but also get food stamps, they get all the free food and they get all the free soda and all the free garbage. People that work hard, make enough money that they don't qualify, they can feed themselves in America. There is no shortage of calories when I say food. What is there a shortage of? Good food, nutrient-dense food, nutritional food, high-value food. There is a shortage of it because we grow so much crap and we turn decent food, it's not great, but it's decent, and we turn it into garbage because we can sell it for more money that way. There's probably not a person listening to me that can't produce some of their own meat. I live in an apartment. Get 2 quail cages and stack them. Make 1 for layers and 1 for growing out incubated chicks. And you can produce some of your own meat. I have a little small yard. Yeah, start raising rabbits. Rabbits don't have enough fat. Cook some freaking bacon with your rabbit and shut up. I don't want your bullshit excuses. Okay? Buy your bacon. Cook a few ounces of bacon with every rabbit and you got all the fat you need. Right? Stop buying seed oils. Every solution is doable from nature because we didn't get here without nature. Magic didn't get us where we are as a species, including some of the amazing technology that got us here. Like the fact that we can literally put a man on the moon. And those of you that don't think we did that, I don't have time for you today. Okay. Like the fact that you're walking around with a computer in your pocket that has about 1,000 times more computing power than all the banks of computers at NASA when we put a man on the moon. Okay? We have amazing technology, but every resource is still natural. What is this phone, this computer in my pocket made out of? We've got rubber in a case, comes from a tree. We got metals that come from the ground. We have plastics that come from petroleum products out of the earth. What else is there that makes this? Software that comes from our minds. Apps are just a form of software. It comes from our minds. But the physical product is rooted in natural resources. Glass is a natural resource in its root. Metals, the silver that's in here, is a natural resource. Everything that we really depend on comes from nature. And food, nature's a food-producing machine, if we'll learn to work with it. We all should be growing some of our own food. We all should be developing parallel economies like I talked with John about yesterday. All of us. But it's up to us. And this is the reality. The belief in magic, the too much magic type of magic, is rooted in the fact that we look around and we know most people aren't like us, and we're empathic people, we care about others, and all these people that are sick and dying and whatever that could take our path, we want them to have a solution. We want to believe that somebody's going to get elected, somebody's going to get appointed, somebody's going to make a discovery, somebody's going to cure cancer. Do you know why we haven't cured cancer yet? We have no interest in it financially. What is the value of the cancer? I don't even know the answer to this question. If somebody wants to look it up while I'm doing this before I finish, I'd love to know, what is the total value of the cancer industry in America alone? How much money is made by the diagnosis, treatment, and monitoring for cancer? I don't know what the number is, but I know it's in the hundreds of billions, just to, as an educated guess. You're asking the people that make billions and billions of billions of dollars to put themselves out of business when you say cure cancer. So how do we cure cancer? Well, the first thing we do is we start by, what if we could make sure that a lot of the cancers never happened? Or they happen so slowly that our body would be able to fight them off until we died of other natural, like old age causes anyway. Well, if we look at how many people died of cancer 200 years ago, it's totally possible. It really is. Like, we have not had our lives extended by science in the way that you've been told. We have, but not in the way you've been told. You have this belief, $164 billion in 2022. I think that number's low, but I'll take it. You think people making $164 billion want to not have $164 billion? Right? Do you really think that's the case? But yeah, there was not really anywhere near the amount. And we have better diagnostics. You notice when somebody dies, okay? You notice when somebody dies. So what did we not do 200 years ago? We didn't eat seed oils. We didn't have high fructose corn syrup. We didn't buy food in a box sitting on a shelf that was shelf stable for 2 years with all the things in it that make that happen. Poor people weren't obese. Maybe just that would knock out, like, I want to say half of all cancer, but I'll say 25%. Wouldn't that be the place to start? If we could avoid 25% of all cancers, wouldn't that be, like, think about it this way. If you are a father of a family, your number one job is to provide for, protect, and keep the peace in that family. That's your prime directive, right? You come home, your two sons, one's 16, one's 15, are just beating the shit out of each other. Before you worry about who started it, before you punish anybody, before you have a conversation about why it's not nice to beat the shit out of each other, before you talk to mom about it, before you investigate the claims each side makes as to why the fight started, before you do anything, what is your first thing that you do as a father? You come home, your two kids are beating the shit out of each other. You do what? You stop the fight. That's the first thing. You grab heads and you bang them together if necessary to make your point, and you put them away from each other and you say, cut the shit. Then there it is. Break it up, right? Break it up. I'll tell you how it got done when I was a kid. I didn't have a brother, but like with a friend, it didn't matter if I was at my house, a grandparent's house, an uncle's house, or my friend's house. If me and my friends were getting into it physically, that's what we got. Heads cracked together. That shit hurts and it gets your attention and you realize, like, okay, I'm not in charge of this shit anymore. I better listen to the old man, right? The first thing, you stop the fight. So if you want to stop cancer, the first thing you do is prevent the cancers that are easily preventable. That's how we fix everything, though. What are the things causing the problem? First, eliminate those. And so much of what we have done, and this is where too much magic comes in. We've built a society that's about making as much money as you can, as fast as you can, no matter what the cost is to others. That's not capitalism. When you take that mindset, people want to say it's crony capitalism or untethered capitalism, but no. When you get that, plus you create an environment where the government is able to protect and pick and choose winners in this. And the government benefits back from regulatory capture from it. And the whole thing becomes incestuous. You call that fascism. This is fascism run amok, not capitalism run amok. Just because there's elements of capitalism within fascism doesn't mean it's inherently fascist. Just like there's elements of socialism in fascism. In fact, Nazism is national socialism. Okay, that's what it meant. National socialism. We're opposed to socialists. We're national socialists. Oh, okay. See how that works? Keep everybody divided. So it's also not inherently socialist. It's its own thing, and it draws elements from other places, the worst thereof. So we have to, like, separate ourselves from this. This video that I showed you at the very beginning, again, the one with Tucker Carlson, the pharmaceutical guy, this is the one that made my wife. I know I keep saying this, but you guys do not understand the leap for that woman to say, we need a community and not let anybody else in. That is, I don't even say not to let anybody else in at all. I say not to let them in to live there. She's like, no, they don't even get to come through the frigging gate. Like, if you're not one of us, you're out. Like, that mindset in my wife is so foreign to me. But it wasn't, hey, look at the national debt. Hey, look, the zombies might steal our tomatoes. It was, look what they're doing to our children. Because she looks at that little boy and that little girl every day differently than I do. I'm like, I need to kick their ass and turn them into, you know, fine, upstanding young man and young woman. She looks at them and says, I want them to be that way for as long as possible so I can hug on them and love on them. Because this is probably my last thing like this. Like, we're getting older and we may know our great grandchildren, but not the way we know these kids. We know that we are finite individuals. And when she looks at that and thinks, but those great grandkids will come someday. They need a place that they're insulated and protected from this. But we can't run away. We can't. I mean, I'm not saying not to do the community or whatever. I'm saying we can't run away. We can't get away from it, and we can't fight it. All we can do is abstain from it and realize that what we do is the most important thing. There was a person that was here at the very beginning today in the live chat, and I had just started with the videos of the pharmaceutical industry, and I was so proud of them. I mean, I want people to show up and listen. I really do. And hopefully maybe he'll listen later on the audio. But he said, I'm getting too worked up. I can't take this. I'm going out to the garden. Dude, if you listen to this later and you hear me now and you like, that was me, you got an A+ at your final exam, PhD level in Jack Spirko University today. That's exactly what you should have done. When you find yourself getting too worked up about this, especially when you already knew, go do something proactive. We need to build as much food production into our lives as possible. That's one thing we don't need. We need to drive down our cost of housing, and that includes energy and things like that. We need to do all the things that we talk about because it's our only alternative. And it's the way the world should live, but you can't tell people what they need to be doing when you're not willing to do it. Otherwise, you're the climate activist that's throwing tomato soup on a picture that's 400 years old covered by plexiglass and super gluing yourself to the floor because you're worried about oil, but then you, after you get bailed out of jail, you get in your car and you go to Starbucks and you buy avocado toast. That's what you are. You're no better than they are if you don't make the changes in your life, but yet you're saying what society should change. What you're saying is, I want somebody to do it for me. And you're believing in too much magic, and the magic won't come. The real magic is, these are all things that you can do. You have that power. I'm going to do something I normally don't do. I'm going to end with a biblical story. But I'm going to give like the Reverend Jack alternate view of the biblical story. So Jesus at one point is preaching to the multitudes. And his disciples come to him and they say, Master, the people are hungry. And he said, well, then we have to feed them. Go out and see what's available. And it was like 2 loaves and 7 fishes or something like that, right? I don't remember the exact number. I don't need to. It doesn't matter. Wouldn't matter if it was 100 loaves and 200 fishes. You can't feed the multitudes with that, right? So whatever number it was, he takes it and he starts breaking it apart, and it just becomes more and more and more and more and more, because somebody gave everybody eight. And there was so much food that the dried fishes and the bread that were handed out to the crowd, at the end of feeding everybody till they were full, they went around and picked up all the extra food so it wouldn't be wasted. And they had baskets and baskets and baskets of food, yet they only started out with, you know, two loaves and five or seven fishes or whatever it was. And everybody goes, wow, a miracle that Jesus did that. And they missed the whole lesson. If you think the lesson in that story is that if God came to earth as a man with all the power of God, he could make more food for people to eat, you missed the whole thing. Nothing about that is actually miraculous if you believe God has that power. Like, if God was here sitting next to me, God came down and said, yeah, I'm here, I'm with Jack. I'd be like, whoa, God, what's up? Right? And but then if God did, and you believed it was God, and God said, you know what, I'm going to make it dark outside where everybody is at right now, and it got dark, and they somehow put it back the way it was, it would be amazing. But in the end, it's not really a miracle. It's God. Of course God can do that. What was the whole purpose of the New Testament? To show you how to act. I know that you have to believe in Jesus and profess your faith and all, but that's not the main purpose. Christ was the way shower. So does that mean you're supposed to get up on a hill and start breaking fish and bread apart and feeding the multitudes? Can you do that? Actually, you can. You just can't do it in a single afternoon. How many wheat berries do you think go into two loaves of bread or five loaves of bread or whatever, five loaves of bread? It's probably a lot. What if you took all those wheat berries, planted them into the fertile part of the field, cultivated the wheat, and then harvested it? How many people would the berries to make five loaves of bread feed in one crop? And if you took the seed and reserved most of, half of it, and did it again, now how many people would it feed? Now how many people would it feed? If you took two fish, male and a female, and you put them in a pond, you took care of them, you managed them, you bred them, and they had thousands upon thousands of babies, and you did that one or two more times, how many people would you be able to feed with the fish? And then, if you took the results of that and always reserved some back and continuously expanded what you were doing in a natural, healthful way, when would you run out of food? And the answer is you would never run out of food. You would have ever living abundance of that food. So much so that the people you were feeding would have food that could be collected and go elsewhere, not to be distributed, but to be used to produce more. The entire message of that story was that we can feed each other. It was that we can feed each other because, of course, God can do a miracle. Again, I'm not a religious person, but if you are, you shouldn't even, like, that doesn't even faze you. I can put myself in that mindset and say, well, if I believe that all these things as they're written literally, and you told me God did a thing, okay, well, God, it's God. I'm no more amazed by that than Q on Star Trek snaps his fingers and the ship disappears. He has the power. The message was, you have the power. You have so much power, there's no need for you to ever fear hunger if you'll use it. In fact, you have so much power, you can feed more than just yourself and your family. You can feed the multitudes with a few fish and the berries that make a few loaves of bread. I don't know if anybody's ever explained it to you that way before. I don't know if I have like the entire religious committee spinning in knots right now, angry about me saying it this way. That's what I always got from it. And I think it's actually a much more powerful message than God can do anything, because we already accept that. That's a given. It's God. But the works that I do, you will do, and more so, you may not be able to do it with a snap of your fingers, but we can provide in abundance a surplus of all that people need. We can grow enough wood to provide all the heat we need in a way that the tree never dies. We take a tree that lives 100 years and make it live 2,000 years and constantly take fuel from it. It's called coppicing. It's technology. It's ancient. Breeding fish is ancient technology. Planting the seed of the thing that you eat so there'll be more of it. Understanding the seed so you harvest it at the right time and don't plant it until the right time. And you store it in a way where it doesn't degrade before you plant it is technology that is ancient. Taking organic matter and breaking it down so that you have fertility is technology, but it is ancient. Using the warmth of the sun as an energy and the light of the sun as an energy source. We have made it more advanced through a photovoltaic panel, but the basic use of that energy is ancient. People long before Christ walked the planet used it to take dates and figs and grapes and dry them and preserve them as food for time forward. There is nothing that we need to do that is beyond our reach. Well, you know, you could get sick and die, and I could get hit by a car and die, and I could get hit by a meteor and die. I could make a mistake and fall off a mountain and die. I could get struck by lightning and die. It doesn't change anything. What matters is what I do while I breathe, while I still have my dash. So, ended a little bit upbeat on something that started off pretty brutal. The brutal stuff didn't go away, guys. It's still there, but it's up to you to do something about it. If you like this show and the work that I do, please consider supporting us. There are a lot of ways that you can do that. One is a way that I think will benefit you as much as it will benefit me. I really encourage you, if you haven't done so yet, to consider taking our bioreactor compost course. I really do. You know, you can take things that people see as garbage, and by putting them together the right way and giving a little bit of care and moisture and time, you can produce something that is incredibly bioactive and will grow the hell out of food for you. Bioreactor compost is pretty amazing. If you're watching the video, you just look at the screen and see two plants, one planted in a really good potting soil, one planted in the compost. There's not even a comparison. You can't argue the results. It's $40. If you're an MSB member, it's $35. Mortimer here is saying, I took it and fully endorse it. It is one of the easiest things you can learn how to do. And there's a reason that I made it my first course that I ever charged money for. It is the root of everything else that we'll teach. Even when we get into livestock, like raising rabbits and whatever, what do you do with the waste stream? How do you follow the permaculture principle of produce no waste? You turn it into something incredibly valuable. Billy Bond, who is a hell of a composter, I would call him a compost artist, looked at what I'm doing and he said, I would rather have a gallon-sized Ziploc bag of the compost you make than the best compost I can buy a pickup truckload of. Because he understands that biology is the solution. Tomorrow, I'm going to be answering a question that came in today on my part of the Expert Council show. Why don't I endorse Mettweiler-style gardening? Because it's a chemical versus a biological solution. Chemical solutions are always inherently limited, and biology is inherently limitless, right? There's nothing we can't do with living things around us. On that note, I also do recommend that you guys learn to start your own plants. If you are going to be dependent on anything, you probably shouldn't be dependent on nurseries. This is another place that inflation's just gotten out of whack. I remember buying, you know, I remember being upset at paying like $3, $2.99 for an individual tomato plant, but still being able to come on the air and go, you're learning a skill. You're learning a skill. So what? Buy four tomato plants for your garden this year. It's $12. plant them. Don't worry about $6 for a tomato plant that's now smaller and weaker and chemically saturated compared to even 10 years ago. I can't do it anymore. So I really recommend you start your own plants. My item of the day today are the 2-inch nursery pots for starting seedlings that I had out a couple days ago. They're $20 for 100 of them. They're really awesome. I love the way they're designed. On the bottom, they let a lot of water in for your watering from the bottom, or they let a lot out if you're watering from above to make sure you get good drainage. And the bottom of them, I think this is something I didn't tell you guys about the last time I ran them. It's really awesome, and I don't know how well you can see this, but you do have the holes, but you'll notice that the holes are in two different groups. And so you have kind of your holes in the cross formation, if you're looking at the screen right now, that are recessed up, and then you have the ones that are kind of on an angle, like a 45-degree angle. They're on little squares. Those little squares actually go deeper down into wherever you set them as far as a pan to sit. So they have the ability to wick even when it's a very small amount of water. And they even have a little tiny, you probably can't see it, but there's a little tiny peg right on that square where those angled holes are that holds the pot up a couple millimeters above the bottom at all times. So you get good drainage and good wicking. They're flexible, they're awesome, and they're cheap. You know, I said this yesterday with John. I'm all for buying local, et cetera. That's a big part of the solution. But there are things that are mass market style products that this is the place to go to the mass market for. And with a simple seedling setup right now in an area that's about a foot and a half, 2 foot deep by about 3 foot long, I'm starting 100 plants. Say you can get them for $4 a piece. It's $400. $20 worth of pots that are reusable, $50 worth of lights that are reusable, and potting soil I made mostly from my own compost and my own biochar, which I teach you guys how to do. Please believe me when I say the solutions are not in magic, even though sometimes it may feel like magic, to be able to take something like a compost and change an entire, you know, pasture's profile. It's not magic. It's biology. It's nature. It's where all the solutions are. So if you want to support our work, use what we provide, what we teach, and what we recommend to improve your own position in life. With that, I'm going to say thank you for tuning in today. This was a great turnout. Usually when I talk gloom and doom, that's when more people show up. I prefer to stick to solutions. Tomorrow we'll have an expert council show and a Friday flashback, and starting Monday we'll do it all over again. By the way, we got a bunch of people requesting to be guests on the show from the one little shout out I did about that. Some really exciting and new stuff coming very, very soon with our guest interviews. But the other thing that I still need, if you're out there listening today and you're thinking I could contribute, I need some new expert panel members. There's definitely some expert panel members that are getting cut because they don't participate enough. And then there's some I think that we just kind of wore out their area of expertise. Like you can only ask a person so many questions before you've asked them everything. So we need some new stuff. Be prepared if you volunteer and say you want to be on for me to give you an audition, which will be like make up a question or here's a question, send me an audition, and it has to be in a timeline. But if you can do that and you're ready to go, let me know, because what I would like to do is go back to having my expert council shows be my easiest show of the week, because right now they're not. Right now, every week I'm scraping right to the end. Even though I have some great people, I can't put on, you know, 3 answers from Nicole and 3 answers from Doc Bones on the same show. I need variety. So if you're on the council and you want to stay there, quit piking. If you want to be a member of the team, let me know. Send me an email, jackofthesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC in the subject line. And I'll catch you tomorrow with that expert council show. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.